The weird thing about ghost stories is how much we love them and how much we absolutely refuse to believe them. I mean, yeah, there are cable TV shows like Ghost Hunters or The Dead Files, but you and I both know that the editors at The New York Times or NPR would have to be dead themselves to consider running a serious, credible story about ghosts or spirits or communication with the dead. And yet, a lot of people say they've had those experiences. So when and how did we decide their stories were too loony to take seriously? Jeffrey Kripal is a historian of religion at Rice University, and he has an answer. Steve Paulson wanted to know more.
Jeffrey, you are a historian of religion. Why did you get so interested in the paranormal?
Well, because I spent about 10 years in the late 90s and turn of the millennium studying something called the human potential movement. And during this time, I kept running into individuals who told me about extraordinary experiences that they had that I couldn't account for. And it was clear to me they weren't lying and they weren't making it up. And so I went back to the literature and to my own training and discovered with some dismay that I had nothing. I had no way to explain any of this because we had essentially erased it from the field, even though all of these terms originated among intellectuals in the 19th, early 20th century. We had essentially either forgotten them or suppressed them. No conspiracy theory here. It was just a historical observation.
And you're talking about people like William James?
William James, Frederick Myers, the London Society for Psychical Research. What happened in the 19th century around Cambridge was that a number of intellectuals were enamored, actually, of the new scientific methods, but they also thought that these weird anomalous events were real. And so they wanted to use the tools of science to study these anomalous experiences. And the assumption is that there were natural forces at work in these events that we simply didn't understand yet, but that someday we perhaps could.
You mentioned Frederick Myers, one of the people you write about.
Right.
Why are you interested in him?
Myers was a classicist at Cambridge University. He was an expert on Latin and Greek. He was the man who invented this new word, telepathy, which is an important word that's often misunderstood.
Wait, what is misunderstood about telepathy?
Well, when people hear the word telepathy, they think somebody trying to win a horse race or do well on the stock market or something silly. Where in fact, what the word means is profound emotion or profound suffering, pathos, at a distance, tele. And what Myers had in mind was these experiences were inevitably around death again. You know, the classic case was somebody would wake up in the middle of the night and they would see grandma or a child at the foot of the bed waving goodbye or dripping wet or something. And they would find out the next day or a couple days later that grandma or the child had died or drowned at more or less exactly that time. And so what Myers felt, what hit Myers and his colleagues like William James felt, was that what a telepathic communication was a profound state of fear and emotion and love and suffering that was somehow sending out signals on levels that we're not aware of, and that these signals would then surface as a dream or as a waking vision. And so what they had in mind, again, was these emotional connections of love. They weren't talking about predicting the stock market or a horse race.
So the question is what to make of these kinds of experiences. And lots of people say that they have had paranormal experiences. And scientists, of course, I mean, the scientific establishment basically dismisses them out of hand. They say that these are examples either of quackery or gullibility. Where do we go from here?
Well, you know, the scientific method has advanced so far over the last few centuries precisely by removing the subjective, removing the mental component, and controlling simply the physical material world in very precise ways that can be predicted and measured. And so the problem with these experiences is they don't play by the rules of science. For one thing, they're clearly not just about material physical reality. The other rule they break is they're not repeatable. You can't get the sort of mind-blowing, spontaneous life-changing experiences in the laboratory because, A, they're almost always spontaneous, and, B, they're usually around some trauma, some death, or some profound suffering event of a human being.
You're talking typically about once-in-a-lifetime experiences.
I am. And often these things, again, happen around the death of a loved one or one's own death or near death. And that isn't something we're going to replicate in a laboratory.
So your goal then is to help to try to create an intellectually safe space where you can study these very weird things?
That's my goal. I'm the humble little humanist in the corner raising his hand saying, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? And just trying to kind of fashion a way of talking about these things that isn't so polarized and isn't so dogmatic and that can listen to like real human beings talk about real experiences with a frankly, more compassion and more open-mindedness.
So how do you go about this? I mean, you are a professor at a prominent university, the chair of your religious studies department, right?
Right.
Do you invoke particular scholars who have credibility?
I use a lot of case studies from scientists who have had their own paranormal experiences and who have written about them in a very balanced way. And so that kind of breaks down this notion that oh, it's just weird scholars of religion over here talking about this thing.
Who are some of these scientists we should know about?
Well, one of the strangest stories I've ever heard is from a biochemist named Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for Biochemistry in 1993. He published an autobiography called Naked in the Minefield. I think that's the name of the book. But in one, he has a whole chapter, actually, on what looks a lot like an abduction experience. He had gone up to his cabin in California, and it was midnight, and he was walking to the outhouse to answer nature's call, and he came around a corner with his flashlight, and there was a glowing raccoon standing there, like literally glowing. And it said to him, "Good evening. Good evening, doctor." And the next thing he knew, it was 6 hours later, and he was walking up a road towards his cabin without those 6 hours of memory. That was in 1976. In 1986, Whitley Strieber published his book on his own abduction experience called Communion. And both Mullis and his daughter immediately recognized something of their own experiences around that cabin in Strieber's book. And so there again, you have this resonance between an autobiographical account from a horror fiction writer of something that he claimed really happened, and you have that resonating with a Nobel Prize-winning biochemist.
Are we basically talking about consciousness and sort of trying to come up with a better way to think about this? Because, I mean, what you're obviously doing is you're challenging the standard neuroscientific model of consciousness, which is, you know, everything that happens in the mind comes from the physical mechanics of an individual's brain, and you simply can't explain a lot of this stuff, it would seem, using that model.
Right. This is why psychical experiences are rejected. Look, if a man knows that his grandmother is dying 1,000 miles away 2 hours before she dies, and he knows that instantly and definitively, we have no model for that because in our model, we have to get that information into his skull somehow through a phone call or through a letter or something. We have no way of understanding how two separate individuals separated so far in space and time could be communicating. If, however, consciousness is not produced in toto by the brain inside a bony skull, if it in fact is located outside space and time, then there's absolutely nothing to prevent that communication from happening. In fact, you would expect exactly that kind of communication. So that's clearly the model there, or the hypothesis I'm moving toward. But again, I'm not a scientist. I'm a historian of comparative mystical literature. And that model works really, really well for me because it explains my data. It explains my literature.
Jeffrey Kripal is a historian of religion. His history of the paranormal is called Authors of the Impossible.